Nearly 100 years ago, the 18th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution banned liquor. You probably know that time is prohibition, but you might not know that some anti-liquor advocates teamed up with the KKK to target immigrants, especially Italian and French ones in Illinois. Here's Harvard professor Lisa McGurr.
In some Law and Order public meetings, they actually argue that those who are responsible for eroding your way of life are those immigrant men and women from across the sea, and they promised that they would essentially force them out.
Also, every day, 30 million students across the country get their lunch at school. But what happens when the school year ends?
We always say that summer can be the hungriest time of the year for kids and the most expensive time for parents.
That's Megan Kuchar from the Illinois State Board of Education. We'll have more on ISBE's summer food service program right after the latest news. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Every day, 30 million students across the country get their lunch at school. Two out of three of those lunches are free. That's according to 2017 numbers from the USDA. But what happens when school's out? Here in Illinois, just 15% of children who receive school lunch during the year get a free or reduced lunch during the summer. The Illinois State Board of Education has been working on this disparity through their summer food service program. It helps provide meals at more than 2,000 sites throughout Illinois. But ISBE said more places are needed to solve the problem. Joining me now on the line from Springfield, I have Megan Kuchar, who's from the Nutrition Division at the Illinois State Board of Education. Also with us from Evanston is Kim Minestra, who's the Director of Nutrition Services for Evanston Township High School. Megan, Kim, thanks for being with me. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Megan, first, let's just start. If you can explain a little bit about the summer food service program, how does it work with these sites? Are most of these sites existing schools, or are they other locations as well?
We have what you call a sponsors of the program, and then we also have feeding sites. So the sponsors are the organizations who are ultimately responsible for the program. They receive the federal reimbursement through the USDA, and they take care of, you know, providing the meals to these sites. Now, a feeding site, it doesn't have to be anything in particular like a school. It just is a physical location where the children can come get a meal. We have several types of feeding sites. We have parks, churches, playgrounds, camps, anywhere where the children are, that is the ideal location for a feeding site.
And when we're thinking about those sites then, how many are there across Illinois, Megan?
So across Illinois, as of summer 2018, we had about 2,200 feeding sites, and we had around approximately 300 sponsors. They're called feeding sites technically, but it could be, you know, just where a group of kids meet, not only to receive a meal, but we usually encourage our sponsors to have some type of activity or programming going on to kind of reduce that stigma of, you know, saying a feeding site. It's more than a feeding site. It's an enrichment program. You know, kids can come talk to each other, play games. It can be educational in ways, too, other than just receiving a free meal.
And Kim, I wonder what this looks like in Evanston. How many different locations do you guys have?
So we are just a one district, or one school district. So we have our program running here for students that are part of the summer school program. In addition to that, we provide meals to 10 different sites throughout the city of Evanston, and those are summer camps.
And how many students are you all serving through the locations you have right now that are summer food service program sites?
At the district, we serve about probably 800 to 900 meals a day for lunch and maybe about 200 breakfasts a day. And then for the off-site camps, we do about 1,100 lunches a day and about 300 snacks, and we're going to start adding breakfast next year.
And why are you going to add breakfast?
We just feel like there's a need, kind of, you know, why we're on this call is exactly that. You know, there's a lot of families that can really benefit from partaking in this program, and especially because it's free across the board. It's pretty great because even the public can come up if you're under 18, and even if you're not part of those camps, to grab breakfast or lunch. So it's just a great program for those families that are in need.
Megan, what do we see in terms of the summer if it is a particularly difficult time for students who may have families who are not able to afford proper nutrition, proper food, enough meals on the table every day?
So millions of children, they do rely on, you know, those free and reduced price meals throughout the school year, but they no longer have access to those meals once schools close for the summer. So we always say that summer can be the hungriest time of the year for kids and the most expensive time for parents. You know, that's so true because normally when their kids are receiving, you know, a breakfast and a lunch and maybe a PM snack every day at school, when you take those away for the summer, you have to think about how much they're spending on their children when they normally receive those types of meals during the school year. So you have to think about a parent spending money on breakfast, lunch, and a PM snack or whatnot for their kids when it's not provided for them. So that's really what this program essentially does. You know, they're trying to fill that gap.
And that gap exists not just in the summer, but then also in terms of locations, right, for summer food service sites. So I mentioned this at the beginning, Megan. Are there 33 counties in Illinois that do not have any service sites?
Correct. There are 33 counties which we are looking to have sponsors, or in order to have sites, we need to have sponsors. So really that's what we're looking for in those 33 counties is a sponsor.
And what does that mean? Just first of all, before we get to what it means to be a sponsor, what does it mean in terms of how many kids are getting meals during the school year versus the summer, given the lack of access in these 33 counties?
Approximately 1.1 million children are eligible for free and reduced price meals throughout the school year. But No Kid Hungry, they do a bunch of statistics on this. And using the National School Lunch Program as a benchmark, if we take 100 students who are eligible and participating in the National School Lunch Program, only 48 are participating in breakfast and only 12 are participating in summer out of 100 students. So you can see that it is a large gap for summertime, and we're not quite sure why that is. We brainstorm every year with our partners, seeing, you know, what's missing, what can we do better to serve more children, things like that. But we are still trying to fill that gap, essentially.
Does it seem like things are getting better or worse, Megan?
I would say for the past couple of years, we've kind of stayed consistent. Our number of sponsors have decreased quite a bit, but we still have about the same amount of sites from year to year. We were only down 1% in the number of sites this year, so that's good. I mean, it could be worse, but we always are looking to increase our number of sites.
And how does a sponsorship work, Megan?
So in order to become a sponsor, we look for 501c3 organizations. So that could be public or private nonprofit schools, units of local, municipal, county, state government, private nonprofit organizations, or private nonprofit camp, any of those types of organizations. They can reach out to us and we would kind of walk them through the entire process. But they would need to attend annual training provided by ISBE. And we have our trainings coming up February through May. And so next couple of months we'll be having those, and we go into a lot of detail about what it is to be a sponsor and what is expected of them. But essentially they would work on either providing a meal via, you can either self-prep your meals or you can vend your meals with a contractor. But they would be the ones to receive the federal reimbursement and find sites to feed the children at. We always say the first year is always the hardest, you know, because you do have that learning curve. But once you get the hang of things, we've had sponsors in the program for 15, 20 years. You know, they stick with it because they do see the benefits.
And Megan, when you say sponsorship, are there any finances involved? Is there any cost to them?
So it depends on how they run their program. If they're running it efficiently, they should either break even or they might be losing money. We do say that up front, but how it works is we reimburse them via meals times rate. So say you serve 100 lunches a day times the new reimbursement for lunch is about $4. So they would get $400 if they served 100 meals that one day. So that $400 should cover all the operational and administrative costs that are associated with running the program.
We're talking about different summer food service programs. And Kim, I wonder if you can explain a little bit about how it works for Evanston Township High School, how that budget works for you all, if you're able to make it work financially in terms of providing nutritious meals for children.
Yeah, we are. We basically run our summer program just as we would run our lunch program. So we have staff that are fully capable of making those meals and are familiar with the menu. And we also work throughout the summer, so we're here to, you know, observe and make sure things are running properly. This is our third year taking on the city of Evanston. So they actually provide a meal cost to us, and they are the ones that are reimbursed for those meals. So it's kind of a win-win situation because, you know, we are getting, they're paying for the food and the labor portion that we would have, that we would normally have to provide, and then they get the reimbursement, so it's a win-win situation.
And how does it work in terms of nutrition and trying to figure out providing a nutritious meal?
Well, what's really great is at Evanston, we have an amazing garden. We got about 3,000 pounds of produce out of our garden last summer, and so, as you know, in the Midwest, there's not a lot of opportunity to use that produce other than the summertime. So we make sure that we, on the menu, provide options to utilize that produce. So lots of salads, you know, sandwiches that have, you know, lettuce and tomato on them, pasta salads, all different kinds of things. Also on Fridays, we are not in session. We don't have school on Fridays. So we provide all the vegetables and fruits to them on the Thursday before to ensure that they have something to serve on Friday. And then we have a local pizza company that's low-fat cheese, whole wheat crust, delivered directly to those sites so they can still get meals on Fridays when we're not in session.
Megan, when we're thinking about different programs throughout the state, I wonder what kind of encouragement you would offer for people to, if we think about the fact that there are 33 counties in Illinois that will not have these programs this summer. What would you say to get people more involved?
When we're talking about children in the summertime, we're not just talking about hunger. We always talk about the summer learning loss. So many children who face the nutrition gap when the school year ends are also affected disproportionately by summer learning loss. And we also call this the summer slide, and it refers to the loss of academic skills and knowledge come summertime. Quality summer programs can help reduce the summer learning loss, but some of them are either non-existent or unaffordable for many low-income families. So such children return to school in the fall academically behind their higher-income peers and struggling to catch up before, you know, classes even begin. So that is one of the things we really advocate for. It's not just hunger. It's also, you know, that the learning loss portion. But also, we always stress that it takes a village. It takes the entire community to get this thing up and going. Essentially, you know, we would need a sponsor first, but from there, we can help you determine where they want their sites to be, or where, you know, we can determine where the children in the summertime that would be a good site. We can also look at, all right, what is this church doing? Are they having, you know, a vacation Bible school? We can talk to the local unit of government to see how they can pitch in and how they can help. You know, it really takes a whole community to have a productive and successful summer program.
And Megan, when we're thinking about those 33 counties, are there specific parts of the state where there's more need than others?
I mean, there is need across the state, but we find that the more southern parts of the state are the ones with the least amount of sponsors. That's where the majority of the counties are located. And, you know, there's a couple of reasons for that. And one of them being the counties are extremely smaller in, when it comes to size. So there might not be as much infrastructure or organized activities going on. So there aren't as many opportunities to have these summer programs. And also, you know, most of Southern Illinois is a rural area. And so it's all the houses and the schools, they are pretty spread out and far apart. So transportation can also be an issue because, you know, you got to get the kids there somehow. When you're in larger cities, people are more compact and everything is closer together, so kids can essentially just walk to the sites. But in Southern Illinois, you know, that is definitely a challenge. So we're really trying to, you know, find ways around that and come up with different ideas to help combat that problem.
And I'm just wondering, I'm thinking about our main broadcast areas, Megan, so we're on the air in Rockford, Peoria, Bloomington, Normal, Champaign, Urbana, and Springfield. How does coverage look like in those areas?
So we do have, in the central Illinois, we do have some gaps that we are trying to fill in some random counties. I know in Springfield we have quite a bit of sites and sponsors along with the Bloomington area. We're always looking for more in the Champaign-Urbana area. We do partner with the Champaign School District and also Urbana Public Health. They are great sponsors, but, you know, we can never have enough feeding sites. So if there's any interest, we would love to help whoever is interested find a sponsor in that area, and they're more than likely going to be able to pick them up.
Megan Kucher is with the Illinois State Board of Education's Nutrition Division. Kim Minestra is the Director of Nutrition Services at Evanston Township High School. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Support comes from Krannert Arch Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Blue and White Ceramics, an Enduring Global Obsession, with a lecture by porcelain expert Stacy Pearson, this Thursday at 5:30 p.m. More information at kam.illinois.edu.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. What comes to mind when you think about prohibition? Maybe you think about jazz, speakeasies, even gangsters like Al Capone here in Chicago. Well, there was a lot more to it than that, including anti-immigrant violence in many American cities and towns. In many cases, they were led by the KKK, which actually grew in numbers during prohibition. One particularly dark chapter in this history took place in Williamson County, just east of Carbondale. And what happened there, including how many immigrants were killed and how the public pushed back, is part of an opinion piece that Lisa McGurgist wrote in the New York Times. She's a professor of history at Harvard University. She's also author of the book, The War on Alcohol, Prohibition, and the Rise of the American State. And she's on the line with us now. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
Lisa, before we get to what happened in Southern Illinois, I just want to start by asking you about prohibition. I mentioned Al Capone in Chicago, and I think people have maybe popular conceptions of what the era was, and I wonder what you think is missing from that.
I think what's missing from the popular conception is the darker side of prohibition. There is a tendency, a sort of way that we look back and romanticize the escapades of these adventurers and criminal networks from Al Capone to the underground subterranean nightlife, all of which was very real. But there's a very different side to prohibition if you look outside the big cities, or even if you look to kind of working class neighborhoods, which is that prohibition was enforced. It's often thought of as a joke because we focus on the sort of unending supplies of bootleg liquor. But the other side of that was that if you were a sort of immigrant or working class or a kind of rural moonshine supplier, prohibition was enforced and men and women were arrested, fined, and incarcerated for liquor law violations, this was the moment that you see the first sharp rise in the numbers of those in prison at the federal level. You have to remember that in 1920, the FBI was very, very tiny. At that time, it was called the Bureau of Investigation. And it's really prohibition that launches a far greater and qualitatively new role for the federal government in crime control, one that continues after prohibition is rescinded. So all of these are the kind of really important legacies of prohibition that we tend to forget when we focus on gin joints, jazz, and speakeasies.
It's such a different picture that you are painting, which is, I think, really helpful for people to understand thinking about really the rise of the modern criminal justice system as we know it today. So it started at during this era, it sounds like you're saying.
Absolutely. It did start in this era. And of course, remember, the federal government was not the colossus that we know it to be today. And of course, you know, we have a huge, you know, prison population. We've had a war on drugs for the last 50 years. But in this moment, the federal government took on that role for the first time. And at the same time, while there was a huge escalation of its efforts to rein in law and order, to enforce the law, because this was such a hugely ambitious project, right, the idea of banning alcohol from shore to shore, and because the federal government was very, very small, there was no way it could meet the impossibly large ambitions, even though it put in all sorts of efforts. And men and women that had worked so hard to pass it became increasingly dissatisfied. And that is why we get what I talk about in my book on the war on alcohol, the citizens launching a kind of citizens enforcement apparatus, a kind of shadow enforcement army to back up the official law enforcement apparatus at both the federal, the state, and the local level.
So, Lisa, I wonder how then this, as you're talking about the size of the federal government, as you're talking about sort of all of these different state laws, this is where we're also seeing these kind of citizen armies that are trying to enforce prohibition, right?
Right. So essentially, you have coming into prohibition, this was, of course, a long campaign. It had started in the 19th century already. There were very powerful and influential national, what were called temperance organizations, that worked starting in the early 20th century to pass a constitutional amendment, the 18th Amendment. The Women's Christian Temperance Union was one. The other was the Anti-Saloon League. Both of those organizations, once prohibition passed, did not retreat to their homes, but really wanted to work to make to see that the law succeeded. And they morphed to a certain extent into enforcement organizations. They worked with local, state, and federal officials to help ensure the law's success. And the motto of many of them was, every citizen an enforcer. It wasn't enough, in other words, to respect the law, but one had to sort of take on an active position in seeing that other citizens respected the law as well. And this, the Anti-Saloon League and the Women's Christian Temperance Union worked to establish local law enforcement organizations. And they quickly found an ally for that work in the reestablished Ku Klux Klan. With the passage of prohibition, it really flourished, not just in the South, but also in the Midwest and West, where there was a lot of temperance sentiment among white, Native, Anglo-Saxon Protestants who were deeply concerned about drinking, but drinking as a symbol of the changes and shifts that immigrants and Catholics were bringing to the country. And prohibition offers the Ku Klux Klan an opportunity to sell itself to white Protestant evangelicals, those men and women who had worked so hard for the law, as a law enforcement organization. If the police weren't going to do their jobs, they would step in. So it provides a kind of a legitimacy for their 100% quote-unquote, American campaign.
And so, Lisa, an important example of all of this actually happened in Williamson County in southern Illinois, just east of Carbondale. Can you tell us a little bit about how the prohibition worked in Williamson County in particular?
Williamson County was very different. If you're thinking about Illinois as a whole, you know, Chicago was a heavily immigrant city. It was a very wet city. Williamson County, Illinois, had been settled largely by, it was a kind of, Southerners had moved in from Virginia, from the Carolinas. It was largely a kind of native white Protestant and heavily mining community. But in the early 20th century, the mining opportunities had brought in a more diverse group of folks who lived there, including many Italians and French immigrants who came into the community who were also Catholic. There had always been drinking, despite the sort of efforts of Protestant ministers to rein in the drinking of minors. And Illinois had not passed a state prohibition law. But when prohibition came about, those who had worked so hard to pass the law, who saw the continued violations of the law in their communities, Williamson County was also the home of two well-known criminal gangs, liquor supply gangs. And as a result, there was an enormous amount of violations of the law. So essentially, you know, there was an effort by both Protestant ministers and the leaders of the community, particularly a man named Sam Stearns, who was the chair of the Williamson County Board of Supervisors and was also the leader of the local Ku Klux Klan. Sam Stearns essentially launched a campaign to rein in liquor law violations, but that campaign effectively targeted, again, the drinking of others and brought in white Protestant miners who had earlier were really just concerned about their economic grievances and the problem of, you know, the eroding conditions in the mines, into a new campaign to target the drinking of Italian immigrants who also happened to be competing with them for jobs in the mines.
Yeah, so that's so, really it. So it's there's an economic part of the story that people often maybe miss.
In Williamson County, there's absolutely an economic piece. I think that Stearns and Protestant ministers drew in a portion of working class miners precisely because there was a lot of anxiety at this moment. You know, mining was a sick industry in the 1920s. There was increasing job competition. There had been a huge and very, very violent strike and lockout that ended in what's called very well-known Heron Massacre, in which there had been two labor union members who had been killed. And in response, there were a number of mine guards and scabs, essentially, who working-class miners ended up killing. In other words, class violence. And I think there was a lot of anxiety among the middle-class folks in Heron about that. And essentially, the Law and Order crusade that was launched in the wake of the Heron Massacre redirected some of those anxieties toward another target, which was essentially the men and women who had come across the sea. And that's precisely how they identified the threat. In some Law and Order public meetings, they actually argue that those who are responsible for eroding your way of life are those immigrant men and women from across the sea. And they promised that they would essentially force them out.
And there was actually violence, right, at this point, where also there were actually anti-immigrant violent incidents that happened?
Oh, there were. I mean, there was essentially what happened was a campaign of what started out as a kind of prohibition enforcement effort that first targeted the Burgers and the Shelton gang. Sam Stearns himself went to Washington, D.C. He got federal authorization by the Federal Prohibition Bureau in order to launch these crusades. But what are these anti-liquor campaigns? But essentially, they deputized citizen volunteers, between 500 and 1,000 in a series of raids, who spread out across the county, raided sometimes roadhouses and speakeasies, but also raided private homes. Basically, it became a campaign of terror against the immigrants living in the community. The local priest in a oral history interview said that 17 crosses were burned at the time nearby. The Catholic Church itself was raided. Crucifixes were thrown on the floor. This campaign of terror resulted in Italians calling on the vice consul in Springfield to come and take affidavits about the violence they had experienced, about planted evidence about the violation of their rights. Eventually, in another area of Williamson County, The French immigrants called on their consul, who protested to the State Department. In the end, this level of violence, which ended in 14 deaths, and the fighting in the streets led to the calling in of the National Guard, led to essentially local martial law established by Len Small, the governor at the time of Illinois. And there was so much controversy and violence that it eroded support for the Klan by 1925. And there was a shift. So immigrants were not passive in this. There were those who organized in Illinois, but in other parts of the country as well. It was called the Knights of the Flaming Circle, to basically fight back against the Klan. And they also fought back politically. By 1928, immigrants, many of whom had not been involved in the national level in politics, came into the Democratic Party when Al Smith ran, because he was both an immigrant and a Catholic and anti-prohibition. And what we often, I think, understood is a kind of symbolic issue, prohibition being a kind of symbolic attack. In reality, it was concrete and a very, very real grievance for immigrant men and women. In Williamson County itself, about 3,000 immigrants out of 11,000, when it started in 1920, there was a population of 11,000 immigrants. I think the Klan's campaign succeeded in driving over 3,000 out, because the census shows that in 1930, there were 3,000 less immigrants
wow.
in Williamson County.
So, and when we think about that, Lisa, I wonder, you did mention, though, at a certain point, the public actually turns against the Klan. What does that look like in Williamson County? Or is there is then a backlash against this?
There is a backlash in Williamson County. There is, already there had been a backlash more widely in Illinois. So there was a state law that banned the Klan from parading in masks. And in Williamson County, they had totally, said that had been, they paraded in masks right up until 1925. But one, somebody who had been a Klan supporter ran for mayor in 1925 on an anti-Klan platform, essentially saying he would enforce that law, and that succeeded. And there was an erosion of support for the Klan. Eventually, the leader of the anti-liquor raids, a guy who was named S. Glenn Young, who had been a kind of champion for the local Ku Klux Klan, was killed in a gun battle. There was a huge Klan rally at his funeral, which brought in Klansmen from around the state. So they were still active, but there was an erosion of support among officials and very much a backlash. And even evangelical Protestant ministers who had been supportive essentially hold a kind of revival meeting, seeing the level of violence and controversy in the streets, in which they call on, basically their own brethren to turn to prayer and not to sort of, be fighting gun battles in the streets.
Lisa, I wonder, you are a historian, you teach history. I wonder, though, how you see parallels in America today to everything we've been talking about.
The story of Williamson County shows, I think, the way in which particular economic anxieties that at one moment can turn around class hostilities focused on, for example, sort of inequities of private economic power, at another moment can be turned to scapegoat immigrants as the reason, even though it's not legitimate, but nonetheless the cause of one's economic concerns and grievances. I think you absolutely see a parallel. That's what happened in Williamson County. It's what's happened under the Trump administration in terms of, the sort of massive attack on immigrants as the cause of, let's say, American decline or crime. You saw that in the 20s. Immigrants were targeted by, those who supported prohibition as the sort of causal force for crime. In fact, if you looked at the statistics, immigrants were far less likely to be involved in bootlegging than other Americans. There was a study in 1929 which by Edith Abbott that showed that, but there was a scapegoating of immigrants, so that the Indiana, for example, WCPU declared that immigrants were 75% of liquor law violators, a statistic they simply took out of thin air. So there is that kind of targeting and scapegoating, but there is also, I think, what one can see in terms of a parallel to today, a counter response, a mobilization by those who are targeted and attacked unfairly to enfranchise themselves increasingly and become involved in politics. We saw that in the fall election in 2018. We have a far more diverse congressional body in the House, I think, coming out of 2016 as a counter response. And I think we will see more of that counter mobilization going forward.
Lisa McGurr teaches history at Harvard University. She's also author of the book, The War on Alcohol, Prohibition, and the Rise of the American State. She first wrote about this as an opinion piece for The New York Times, and we'll tweet that out for you to read more about this. Lisa, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Support comes from Prairie Melody Premium Black Oil Sunflower Birdseed. Prairie Melody is locally grown, supporting farms in transition to organic production. Information about local retail outlets and more at prairiemelodybirdseed.com/blog. Prairie Melody, it's all about the birds and the bees.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There's been some crazy up and downs with our weather, which I can imagine is also wreaking havoc on your heating bill. Recently, I noticed a Facebook post from University of Illinois law professor Suja Thomas. Every year when the weather gets cold, she posts about how she still hasn't turned the heat on inside her house. It's still 75 degrees inside, and that's because she lives in what's called a passive house. It's especially built to not need external heating or cooling systems. Last year, when I first heard about her house, I went over there for a tour.
Hi, I'm Suja Thomas, and yeah, this is my passive house here in Urbana-Champaign. It's 74 degrees in the house, and we don't have any heat on in the house. And earlier in the week, it was negative 11, and we didn't have any heat on in the house. We've never had temperatures like this, so it was a nice, really nice test for the house that you could even get to negative 11, and I know it was even lower than that, and we had no heat on.
We're standing in front of a really big window, which to my mind would think, oh, this is not going to keep the house warm.
Right. So oftentimes we think of windows as, you know, releasing air and as a result not efficient, but these are very special windows. These are triple glazed windows, and these windows actually allow the sun to heat the house, but it also doesn't permit air to escape easily. You don't really use that much of your house. We kind of noticed that when we had bigger houses. And so kind of the main area is the kitchen and the living room area. And this is kind of the area that where we entertain. So it's worked out really well for us. The house is only 830 square feet, but we can have parties with 30 people in this house. I mean, I think that a lot of us think about the environment and a lot of what we do, whether it be our living in our house or going to work in our cars, those are big contributors for us as individuals. And so if you as an individual want to actually do something for the environment, two of the things that you can do something for the environment with are your car and where you live. It's really great to live in a place where you say to yourself, oh, you know, I'm doing what I can do to help the environment.
Thanks to 21st producers Robin Lynn and Alan Montecilio for producing that. And Suja Thomas is actually in studio with me now. Hi, Suja. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
On the line with us from Chicago is the executive director of the Passive House Institute U.S. She's also the architect who designed Suja's house, Katrine Kleinenberg. Katrine, welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So you've designed, Katrine, you started with 7 homes in Illinois. What does the movement look like now throughout the U.S.?
Well, it has been very impressive over the last couple of years. As you mentioned, we started initially with 7 houses in Illinois, and at that point we were still doing design build. And soon thereafter, there were articles written, and we had a lot of interest nationwide, actually, about what we were doing. We started putting together a curriculum and to train architects and engineers and builders how to build these houses. And from these initial training classes, a lot of projects were built around the country, single-family homes at first. But most recently, we also see a lot of interest in the multifamily, especially affordable sector. And now about I'd say 10 years later, we have little more than 700 projects in the pipeline around the country.
Suja, can I ask, so you don't really have a heating or cooling bill really to speak of per month, right? When you're thinking about how much, when we're thinking about the cost of this, obviously we'll get to the kind of the build costs, but your upkeep costs of this are really low, right?
They're really low. We sometimes turn on an external source of heat, baseboard heaters or our heat pump. But on many days, we don't have any external heat on. And there are probably some people who live in Urbana who probably could live in our house without heat on. We tend to like it a little hot. And so if it tends to be in the, 60s, we want to put some heat on.
And so we mentioned the windows. Your house has 15 inches of insulation on all sides. Does that make it really quiet inside as well?
It is. It's extremely quiet in the house.
And Katrine, why is it important to have that insulation? The house also sits on this huge styrofoam foundation. Is that considered part of the insulation as well?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the most important strategies that you want to employ building a passive house is to have a continuous thick layer of insulation. And that includes the slab or the floor, right? Because it touches the ground. Initially, you would think that that warms up the ground, warms up your slab or your floor, but it doesn't because it's always year-round at about like 50 degrees, and you would always lose heat to the ground. So having a nice big insulation cushion under your slab or floor plate really helps with the comfort of the house.
And there's a few other hallmarks of these. We mentioned and we heard Suja talking about the windows and the special insulation, sort of the specially designed windows and doors. How do you improve? I didn't realize, talking to you about this earlier, I didn't realize lots of homes have a lot of gaps in them. And that's probably a big way we lose a lot of heating and cooling throughout a home, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you ask the Department of Energy or like the energy experts around the country, some crazy numbers of like how many lineal feet of gaps are actually in existing homes. Like they are very, very leaky. And if you have all these gaps in your envelope, and including the windows are not built very well to be airtight. You lose a lot of energy through these gaps and leaks, and also it makes the building uncomfortable. So yeah, stop those leaks, and you just increase your comfort even more.
And then there's also a mechanical system. How does that ensure that there's always fresh air circulating in the house?
Yeah, so the we call it the fresh air system. There is a small mechanical system still that we want and need because we want to exchange air. We want to always have fresh air. We want to have filtered air. And by having that mechanical system that brings in fresh air, we also have the opportunity to recover the heat from it. There's a heat exchange core in it, and the incoming airstream passes by the outgoing airstream. We throw out the pollutants, the moisture, and all the VOCs that we don't want in the home. We bring in fresh air, but the energy that we just produced inside of our home, we want to recycle that back into the incoming airstream, and that's what this little machine does for us. And it runs at very low flows. It's not like a forced air system. It doesn't move around dust at all. It's always fresh filtered air. And so you don't really notice it at all, but you have fresh air 24/7 all the time.
And Suja, and so inside the house, it is like, it's not like stale air. It's not forced air. It's not dry either, right? Whether
no.
It's the winter or the summer, it's kind of the same year round.
Oh, right, right. It's perfectly comfortable air in the house. Yeah.
Right. And so Suja, you deliberately decided that you built this house from the ground up, and you decided you wanted a small footprint for this house to begin with.
Yeah, both my husband and I had bigger houses in the past, and we realized that the space that most people use is the kitchen and the living room area, and we actually like to have parties, and we've had plenty of kind of parties with lots of people, but we use that area. And so, we thought that, we could put less money into the house and put resources into other types of things.
Katrine, how expensive is it to build a house like this? I imagine for a single family unit, this can be much more expensive than if you're doing a new construction that's multifamily, right?
Yeah, so when we first started, the additional upfront cost, of course, that always comes up. And because you use more insulation and you pay more attention to details, there's initially more effort that goes into the planning of the house. And to meet such a tight energy budget, you also want to make sure you have an expert on the team that can calculate your energy balance so that your house will actually perform the way Suja has described. It's really fantastic that they don't have to turn the heat on, right, on a very cold day. So there's some additional costs. We have been able to come in on smaller homes like hers, like I'd say plus or minus 10%, 15% or so. But unfortunately, you're still looking for single-family homes because it's not widespread technology. You're looking at custom design. And custom design is always more expensive. There are no modular homes just yet that when they produce 100 or 200 homes, right, then they can really bring the cost down. But unfortunately, it's not that far in the market yet developed that we have that available. So you'll be looking at a custom home. But when you go into multifamily building design, which we're seeing a lot now, we even see high-rises go up in New York City, at that point, the cost comes down dramatically. And we've seen 100-unit buildings now in New York completed at 0% additional cost, 0 to 1%. And that's fantastic, right? At that point, that's what we want to see.
So, Suja, you had the idea a couple years ago or when you moved to Urbana that you wanted to build this house. Have you ever regretted it? Or especially a winter like this, I think you're probably pretty happy with why you guys chose to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, my husband and I bought a lot in Chicago recently, and we already started thinking about what type of eco build we would do. And we're convinced that, you know, we're going to do a passive house again.
So for people who might be more interested in this, what advice would you give them, Suja?
Well, for sure, look at Katrine's website, and you can Google Passive House and get great New York Times articles that give information about other houses that have been built. Of course, if anyone here in the area is interested in taking a look at our house, we're happy to show it to them. And I'm sure Katrine is happy to talk to people who are interested.
Right. And Katrine, there's for folks in the Urbana area, that note for Suja Thomas. And then, Katrine, you have houses all across Illinois that you've been involved with as well. We have at our website, we have pictures of Suja's house as well as links to the Passive House Institute US. But I want to thank both of you, Katrine Kleinenberg and Suja Thomas, for being with me. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I mentioned heating bills just a few minutes ago. With this cold weather, there are many families in Illinois that maybe are going to have to choose between food and heating when it comes to their costs this winter. Jim McFarland is the volunteer coordinator for Rock River Valley Pantry, and he's on the line with us now. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello.
I mentioned the idea of your heating bill. I wonder how much people are from clients that are coming into the food pantry. Are you seeing people who tell you about how much they're juggling, for example, heating bill costs with grocery bills?
Oh, I think so. And that's where that cost is risen in the heating bill. They don't have enough for food, so they come in and ask for a little support.
And what kind of, I wonder, I think oftentimes we think that we have a picture in our head of people who come to a food pantry. Is there a demographic in particular who comes, or do you find that there's a diversity of people who come needing your services?
I think it's very diverse. Some people would be very surprised about just normal people that are working and have a job, okay, but they can't quite make things stretch. And certainly in the winter, if they have that one more bill, you know, high heating bill.
And Jim, I mentioned you're the volunteer coordinator. What kind of volunteer work do your volunteers do at Rock River Valley Pantry?
We do everything from restocking shelves in the morning, working and guiding our clients through their monthly allotment, helping them shop, if you will, make sure they get a balanced diet. And we also have volunteers go out on our food rescue van. Goes to several places that are donating food.
Thanks for sharing that. Jim McFarland is the volunteer coordinator for Rock River Valley Pantry. Jim, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
By the way, on your state income tax returns this year, you'll have an option to make a donation to help organizations like the Rock River Valley Pantry. Look for a special box on your state tax form to donate to the Hunger Relief Fund. That's a state treasury special fund that buys food grown and processed right here in Illinois and gets that distributed to 8 different food banks across the state. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll begin our broadcast from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. We'll start a series of interviews with members of our congressional delegation, including Representative Sean Casten and Darren LaHood. That's all the time we have for today. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get smartphone apps. It's a good way to find past shows. You download it and set your home station and search for the 21st to follow us. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. Follow us this week, especially. We'll have lots of pictures of what our week is like in D.C. We're also on Facebook. If you want to message us there, search for the 21st. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, just remember our website, which is 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.